Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and looking forward to bringing you a classic replay today featuring well-known Christian thinker, author and pastor Tim Keller, all the way back from 2009. Remember, you can keep up to date with Unbelievable via our newsletter, also the video channel, social media, all the ways to give and support the show. Links are all there at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And if you're a regular listener, you'll know that recently we launched on Pathios as well, a new blog. In fact, there are four blog posts that you can now view. Most recently, this last week, we put one up called Can Skeptics Find a Welcome in Narnia, reflecting on that show between Laura Miller and Michael Ward. And just recently, Tom Holland as well. We've blogged on Tom Holland and a couple of the shows he's appeared on as well, why he changed his mind about Christianity. You're looking for the Unbelievable blog over at Pathios if you want to check those out. You'll also receive them if you simply subscribe to our newsletter. And as you'll hear, if you're receiving this show in the US as a podcast, we've got some very special offers and resources just for you over at our new US website. It's live now, unbelievable.show. Sign up there for additional resources if you're out in the USA, but you won't be left behind if you're listening anywhere else in the world. Just sign up via our regular newsletter too over at the show page. Again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Make sure that all of the links to those are there from today's show as well. I mentioned Tom Holland just there, and he's actually just edited a volume of essays on Jesus the Revolutionary for SBCK. It's by both Christians and non-Christians. So looking forward to hopefully setting something up with him and perhaps one of the contributors on that as well. And mentioning newsletters, actually, just recently on, before we get to Norman Backrack and Tim Keller for today's show, it was great to receive some responses when I asked for what you've been doing creatively to engage people in conversations on a recent newsletter. This came in from Nigel, who said, "I've been concerned for a little while about my lack of contact with people who aren't Christians after starting a new job in a theological college. This became more acute in lockdown, so I decided to open a new Twitter account, made up an alias, and started following various atheist forums and people with atheist and skeptic aliases from across the world. And it's been a fascinating time of learning what people really think and what the real issues are that they have with Christianity. I've rarely started conversations, but do respond to other tweets and comments, and it's led to many deep and personal conversations." What an interesting idea. Thank you very much. Someone else got in touch, actually, with the fact that they still do the good old-fashioned, you know, door knocking and handing out tracts as well in their parish. But, you know, there's lots of ways you can engage people in a conversation, aren't there? Well, today's show is a classic replay. That means we're pulling something out of the archive from 2009. This was not long after the publication of Tim Keller's best-selling book, The Reason for God. At the time, I didn't know Tim very well. We've got to know each other a little bit over the years since. There have been some health updates as well from Tim Keller. I'll fill you in a little bit on that just in the last few months. But for the moment, let's get into this classic replay. He's opposite Norman Backrack on today's show. I'll be introducing them both in just a moment's time. Hope you enjoy today's show. Let me know what you think. We'll be hearing some of your feedback as well to recent editions of the show a little bit later on in the program. For now, here's Tim Keller and Norman Backrack on The Reason for God.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Uh,
Timothy Keller is pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York and the author of The Reason for God, published by Hodder & Stoughton, and it's available in many good bookshops. Norman Backrack is editor of The Ethical Record. Norman, coming on in, if you like, with his atheist hat on today, and we're going to have a fascinating discussion, I'm sure, between Timothy and Norman as the programme progresses. But let me introduce these two guests before I go any further. First of all, Timothy, great to have you with me on the programme today. Those who are regular listeners to Unbelievable may remember that I spoke to you a couple of months back. Mm-hmm. We had a brief conversation, but it's great to have you in the chance to have a proper discussion in this sort of context today. Tell us a little bit about Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York, where you're pastor.
It's a fairly young church. It's about 20 years old. We started it in 1989. It's a church that's largely young people. It's 70-80% single. Most people are in their 20s, young professionals. It's very large in a very secular city, which it grew to several thousand people. And interestingly enough, we don't own a building. We rent space, and we have our services on a Sunday. And one of the services is in the Ethical Culture Society of New York City.
There you go.
That's right.
It's very much not a traditional church in that sense, in as much as you don't have a central, big, ornate building. You're very much, you meet in different locations,
right?
Is that correct?
We rent colleges, churches, other venues, and we rent office space, but we don't have a building. No.
And yourself, is this the first church that you planted? Did you come from a previous church?
It's the first church I planted. I've actually only been a pastor twice. One in a small town in Virginia, blue collar town, and one in Manhattan. That's it. But it's the only church I ever planted. Yes.
And your own Christian journey, did that begin at a young age?
No, I became a Christian in college, embraced Christian faith in college, struggled with doubt. I actually mentioned not much about that, but a little bit about it in the book, The Reason for God book. So.
And so your journey was one of coming to overcome those doubts, presumably.
Yes, but it was in college, right. And I wouldn't, if somebody said, did you ever disbelieve in God and then came to believe in God, I would say, like a lot of people, when I got to university age, I was willing to question the Christian teachings I had growing up, and I went through a period in which I did question them all. I held them loosely, let's say, and then overcame the doubts I had about them and embraced them.
And the reason for God very much emerged, I understand, from your ministry in New York, because it's a kind of a skeptical place, New York, isn't
it? Oh, yes. Pretty much as skeptical as London, I would think. But in a way, I had to redo my struggle. That is, when I was a college student, thinking it through, I came through it and decided I'd be a Christian. But then when I went to New York, I was surrounded by all these young people right out of university, I had to work through all those things over and over and over again for the last 20 years. And so the book is just a précis of those experiences.
Absolutely. Well, we'll get to talking about some of the issues you tackle in the book, and I'm sure Norman will want to very much put the side of the skeptic this afternoon during the program. Norman, do you ever remember having had a faith at any point in the past?
No, I've always been an atheist.
I mean, someone once said that no one is born an atheist because there is some kind of inherent belief in God. And then another person said, no, everyone is born an atheist because you inherit some kind of belief in God. What do you think the natural state is of someone who's just been born?
I think it's a mixture. I think everyone is technically born an atheist, but I think there may be some, this is something we may come on to, I think there is some genetic predisposition in human beings, because we are social animals. Possibly, if you think of a group of chimpanzees, they have their chief, their leader, whom they follow. And there may well be something like that that lingers on in genetics amongst social animals, to look towards a leader of some sort. And that might be genetic, I don't know.
And that might manifest itself as a higher power of some kind.
It can do, yes. And that may be a reason for belief in God.
You're the editor of the Ethical Record. Tell us what that is.
It's the journal of the South Place Ethical Society that began in 1787. An American, L. Fernand Winchester, came to London. He did not believe in hell. He believed that people went to heaven. Mm-hmm. He was a Christian, but he was a dissident Christian, and founded that just little community. And it grew, and a few years later, they disbelieved in the Trinity, and they became Unitarian.
Right.
And then one of their ministers wanted to get divorced, which the Unitarians didn't believe in, so they became independent of Unitarianism. And towards the end of the 19th century, they gave up prayer and all belief. So now, for the last 100 years, you could say it's a humanist society.
What a very interesting journey that has been then. But obviously, it now represents, if you like, yes, a humanist outlook, and that is the worldview you would say you inhabit now.
I think so. Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk more about that. But thank you very much for joining me on the program today. Those are our guests for this afternoon. We're going to, I'm sure, have a very interesting discussion here on Unbelievable, the program, as I often say, that brings Christians and non-Christians together. We're going to be particularly looking at aspects of Timothy's book, The Reason for God. It's been a bestseller stateside. It's just starting to really gain some notoriety over here in the UK as well. So we look forward to delving into some of the issues that Tim brings out in the book. What struck you, if we start out with you, Norman, about the book? Did it raise any issues for you which were pertinent? Any give you any new angles on any of the thoughts about God and Christianity?
Yes, I was quite interested in the book, and in particular Tim's view towards the end about the function of grace and its connection with forgiveness, because I have a different secular view on that whole problem.
Right.
Perhaps we'll come to it.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have time.
But there are a number of issues which he didn't mention, which I think are interesting, about, for example, the existence of consciousness, the fact that human beings, it's not just that we evolved, but we evolved from inanimate life, and all the complexity we now see appears to be as a result of the operation of natural law. Darwin himself ended his book, The Origin of Species, says there's grandeur in this view of life to think, to paraphrase it, that all this complexity, he described a tangled bank with birds and insects and worms all carrying out their apparent purposive activity, and all this resulted from laws just like the law of gravity, the physical laws, and he thought that was what interested him, and that's what basically I believe.
And you, from that point of view, do just believe in the natural world, in the laws of nature, nothing beyond that, nothing supernatural, certainly, that we are simply the product of highly complex, if you like, interactions of chemicals and atoms. There's no such thing as a soul or any meaning beyond the physical universe. Is that fair to say?
Well, that appears to be the picture that science now gives us. It wasn't accepted always. Even you go back 50 years and people were saying in sermons, you can't explain heredity by physics and chemistry. How can you pack all that information for a human being in molecules? How could it come about? Then DNA was discovered, and we now realize that you can explain all the complexities of the human being with the same laws of physics and chemistry that apply in the natural world, rest of the world.
Well, maybe we'll start off in this area then, though we're going to be covering this in a great deal of depth next week as well, so I won't take up too much time today. But you do deal with science in one of your chapters, Hasn't Science Disproved Christianity? What's your main line of thought on this then, Timothy?
Science is a boundaried discipline. When you ask, I think, real scientists, how do you explain why there's something rather than nothing, they say, that's not my job. When you ask them, what makes you think there are human rights? You know, why should human beings be treated with more dignity than a rock or a tree? And if they say, well, they're more complex, and I say, well, no, that doesn't tell you why they should have dignity. And they say, well, that's not something that we can speak to as scientists. I guess I would say that I don't see great contradictions. And I actually feel like, to some degree, that the contradictions between science and religion have been aggravated and maybe exaggerated by people on both sides of the fence who feel that it's a way for them to accrue a little bit more power. Mm-hmm. If you're a scientist saying religion is a farce because we've disproved it, then it gives you more cultural power. If religious people say science is a great enemy, well, you know, religious people like to accrue power by finding an enemy. I actually, if somebody could press me a little bit on it, if you could press me or Norman, I don't see huge huge conflicts.
What are the conflicts for you then, Norman, that you do see?
Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury accepts evolution, so there doesn't have to be. Let's assume he can take him as a mainstream Christian, and Tim also accepts evolution.
Right.
He didn't specify in his book whether he takes evolution right up to and including human beings. I don't know if you would care to answer that, yes or no, you do.
Obviously. Yes, let's say.
I mean, the Catholics or, I don't know, maybe you I do.
I'd go with
a certain point,
with the Archbishop and the Catholics on that.
At a certain point, something supernatural, a soul had to be put into human beings to make them different, either at conception for each human or Adam and Eve, whereas the scientific picture dispenses with that.
Yes.
How do you react to that one?
Well, I don't think – I would say that the scientists can't tell me about the soul. I mean, I know that there have been efforts to weigh – have you heard about this? I thought this is silly. There have been efforts to weigh a person right before and right after they die. Have you heard about that?
I have. And apparently there is a minute amount of difference. Is that
supposedly
correct?
Supposedly there's a minute, and that's the soul that's gone. I just, again, here I have a feeling we're not going to butt heads much on this. I don't think that science can tell me whether I've got a soul or not.
Is it a matter of faith then that you have a soul, or do you believe there is reasons beyond just
I know this might be where we can butt heads a bit. I believe the idea that the future is going to be like the past, or even that there is a past, it takes an act of faith. Because to trust your memory is an act of faith. You can't prove your memories right, or any of our memories right, unless you make a real leap of faith. Because the only way to talk about the past is to rely on your memory, and in other words, you have to assume the reliability of your memory to prove it. I believe the idea of human rights and the idea of justice is essentially something that can't be proven, and I therefore also believe that the soul can't be proven. I believe that an awful lot of things that we use right now, all people, secular people and Christian people, this is my view, we use to live our life are faith assumptions that actually can't be empirically proven. And one of them, for me, is the soul.
Well, I think that the only way I can understand the word soul is to assume that when religious people use it, they're thinking of consciousness, the fact that we can experience everything we do experience, colors, sound, emotion, pleasure, pain, the whole lot. If that's what they mean by the word soul, then it appears to depend on the brain. And this is what neuroscience appears to suggest. You can go to a laboratory not far from here where they will put some electrodes on you, etc. They will be finding out, or by other means, seeing what parts of your brain are active, and they can work out from that what you're thinking of. You can be rendered unconscious by an anesthetic, which suggests that whatever consciousness is, we haven't totally tracked it down yet, of course, it's something that depends on certain chemical processes which can be interrupted by ether or other chemicals. And therefore, at death, the natural assumption to make is that there is no further consciousness and there is no life after death. So I think that would be a point of difference. Tim did mention some other points, perhaps we'll come back to them.
Any response on that level? Are we simply just, you know, experiencing the effect of millions of years of evolution, and what may appear to be something very special is explainable by natural causes?
Well, Norman's right, and he was fair in saying perhaps what Tim means, or what Christians mean, or people mean by soul is consciousness. I would say consciousness, my idea of a consciousness and my idea of what the soul is would be overlapping circles. I can't help but believe that higher primates have something like consciousness. It's difficult to be sure. You know, we can't get inside quite. My idea, really, of the soul is something that some kind of personal residue that actually lasts past the dissolution of our body.
And that doesn't mean
everything that would be our consciousness would be attributable to a soul. Because then, actually, I'm stuck. Because I think Norman's right, that an awful lot of what we could call consciousness is brain activity.
I mean, and you seem to be suggesting that you have, as it were, extra reasons for believing we might have a soul, because we do seem to invest so much value in human beings over any other living thing.
Well, you know what? Listen, I don't know how all the other Christians reason. I believe in a soul because I believe that Jesus rose from the dead, because I looked at the evidence for that, because I read N.T. Wright's 890-page, working on here's the historical reasons why Jesus rose from the dead. But now, I mean, I believe that before he came along, but he helped me.
Uh-huh.
Because I believe Jesus raised from the dead, I actually believe the scripture. And because the scripture tells me about the soul, I believe in the soul. I don't believe in the soul because I sit there and I look at Norman and Justin and other people and I say, oh, look at how their brain, look at how they operate. They must have a soul. I wouldn't get there from there.
Mm. Let's move the discussion on, because if you are interested in the whole science religion area, we'll have a fascinating discussion on that with my guest next week. I'll tell you about that a little bit later. I mean, maybe starting off with the first chapter, Norman, that is a chapter called There Can't Be Just One True Religion. And I guess from your point of view as an atheist, you don't believe there is actually one true religion. You believe they're all false. I mean, but do you see the claims that Christianity makes of being the truth and Jesus being the way, the truth and the life and the only way, if you like, to heaven, as being presumably incredibly arrogant in some sense?
I suppose if one believes that firmly, that is not arrogance, it's their belief. But looking at the whole thing from a slightly greater distance, it appears that every culture in every continent throughout the ages has devised their own form of religion. It could be ancestor worship, it could be the major religions which are still around. And now you've got about four or five major religions with hundreds of millions of adherents who go through their lives believing they're doing the right thing. And they believe in that. And therefore, from my point of view, I see them all as human inventions. That's the humanist view. That, so there can be plenty of wisdom in there, plenty of good sense in it, but it was all created by human beings, and ultimately we've got to judge what bits of it we like and what bits of it we don't like, which comes on to something Tim mentioned just before, human rights, morality, that whole issue. I don't think there is a morality out there, objective. I think all morality is created by human beings. We each have to devise and decide our own morality. There is simply no logical alternative. Even if you decide you're going to adopt some other creed or some other doctrine or follow other person, that's your decision. You can't avoid making that personal decision. And we simply don't accept everything that previous religions have devised. We don't think that homosexuality is an abomination, that adulterers should be stoned to death. Well, even Jesus didn't seem to think that, although I'm not sure about that. But that raises an interesting question. But certainly, if you go to Nigeria now, there's a woman on death row who's going to be buried up to her waist and going to be stoned to death unless someone can persuade the president to grant her a pardon. That's, Islam, not Christianity. But it still goes on. And therefore, I'm just saying that we have to decide which bits of the holy books and the scriptures of the different religions are applicable today. We can't avoid that, in my opinion.
Well, there's a few issues there, but maybe starting off at least with the whole question then, Tim, of isn't it obvious that religions are man-made because they appear in different forms all over the planet, etc.?
Secular humanism is man-made.
Certainly.
So, and here's where I would say that I'm actually sitting in the very same chair as Norman. An ethical humanist or a secular humanist says that I think my take on reality, and that is religions are all relatively right and wrong, and we need to. My take on reality is actually the more accurate one than any one of these religions where they believe that they have all the truth. But basically, I would say, so a secular humanist is saying, actually, my take on reality is more true than theirs, and even though I can take some good things here, my take on reality is more true than theirs. I think, as a Christian, my take on reality is more accurate. My Christian take is more accurate than Norman's. And I, therefore, am no more or less narrow than Norman. I actually also think that that the world would be better if more people believed what I believed. Norman, I think, would think that the world would be better if more people saw things the way he believed. So neither of us is more narrow than the other.
Do you accept that, Norman, that in fact you're in a sense, got just as much a kind of the same way of looking at it as Timothy does, because you're saying, well, I can see everything, actually. I can see the big picture, whereas you can't, Timothy. So in a sense, you're just as making just as many assumptions as Tim is.
I think in principle, yes, with one difference, and that is I think humanists are perhaps more, because they don't have a holy book and a doctrine and a lay-down kind of thing like that, they can be more open, it seems to me, to new evidence about how humans get on with each other, how best to, what kind of legislation to have in the country, what laws, etc. They can be more open, it seems to me, and they can adopt, I mean, I personally would use what I call utilitarianism. It's a complicated word, but it actually means you look for the consequences of an action, and what is its effect on other people's consciousness? Does it cause them pleasure or pain? I don't mean pleasure and pain in any simple sense. By the word pleasure, anything which is a positive feeling. It could be enjoyment or anything whatever positive, and by the word pain, anything which is negative. And you look at the consequences. You can decide how best in that way to adapt to life. So I think humanists are freer to do that than people who are committed willy-nilly to a certain doctrine and just have to make that doctrine make sense and twist it around to do so.
Timothy.
Response?
Well, yeah, I mean...
First of all, that was generous of Norman to say in principle, yes, that we're both, in a sense, equally in belief that our view of things is better. But I would say there's religion and there's religion. And Christianity, for example, frees me to be pretty open to all kinds of new ideas, and here's the reason why. Actually, as long as the Bible is, it seems very long, but essentially it doesn't say that many things. The Bible doesn't tell me what kind of music is the right kind of music. The Bible doesn't tell me, actually, it doesn't give me a whole lot of, even if I believe, and I do, in the infallibility of the Bible, it gives me an anchor. In other words, I know that genocide is wrong. I know that breaking promises is wrong. I know that there's a whole lot of things that are absolutely wrong and some things that are right. And probably, I would think Norman would feel there's certain things that are absolutely wrong and some things are right. And then from that core, he moves out and he's open to other ways of doing things and new ways of doing things. So am I.
You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Briley bringing you this classic replay between Tim Keller and atheist Norman Bachrach. We'll be back very shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's Justin Briley with you for Unbelievable, bringing you a classic replay on this week's edition of the show. This is from a 2009 discussion between Norman Bachrach and Tim Keller, who, for some reason, I insisted on calling Timothy throughout the discussion. I've got to know Tim a little bit better over the years since, and I will bring you a little bit of an update on both Norman and Tim and how they're doing. But for now, let's get back into today's conversation.
If the Bible, and I believe the Bible, if the Bible hasn't spoken to something, then I'm free to figure out, well, what it would be the most wise thing. However, the Bible tells me something about what is good for people. One of the things I find difficult about utilitarianism or other ethical... the Bible says some things are good for human beings because this is what human beings were made for. If you don't think human beings were made for some reason, that they're here by accident, then you are back to this idea of, well, I guess just what gives people pain or pleasure. But, you know, it gives people pleasure to be mean. Some people, I actually get pleasure out of doing some things that aren't good for other people. So I'm not sure that utilitarianism, maybe Norman, yeah. I'm sure I've misrepresented it, but I would say I like having an ethical anchor that actually, in the Bible, that gives me freedom.
Are you saying that humanism doesn't have that ethical anchor, that it is essentially blown by whatever?
Well, there's so many kinds that I need to hear from Norman.
I'd just like to chip in here on a misunderstanding of utilitarianism, which is pretty rife. It may say pleasure is good, pain is bad, but you're not allowed to get your pleasure from another person's pain. That is definitely not allowed. So, for example, sadism or stealing something or anything like that, just because it makes the person who does it happy, makes them happy, it doesn't mean it's right. Because utilitarianism, properly understood, means just think of it this way. Don't cause any pain or any suffering. If, as well as doing that, you can cause some pleasure, fair enough, but you certainly can't...
It sounds a bit like do unto others as they would have, as you would have them do unto you.
That's the sort of golden rule. That could be part of it, certainly.
Now, I was going to say, why is that wrong? Since it's very natural to cause... I mean, you and I are here, if evolution is true, and I believe in a very supplemented understanding of evolution. I believe in God. I believe in the Bible. But the point is that evolution says that we got here through the strong eating the weak, through weak people, weak organisms being squeezed out by the strong. That's absolutely natural. That's completely normal. So why should we now turn on the natural order and say, even though we got here by some beings getting pleasure out of somebody else's pain, why is it suddenly wrong?
Well, 2 points. First of all, human beings are cooperative as well as competitive. Certainly, nature is red in tooth and claw. There's a tremendous amount of suffering in the natural world. This is one of the reasons that Charles Darwin gave up Christianity. 99% of the species have been eliminated. Think of the suffering that they may have undergone. The second point is we don't have to follow automatically because we can choose the kind of morality we wish to adopt. We don't have to say this or that is natural. So although competition and cooperation, well, you can find them both in primitive communities, shall we say, it's up to us today to devise our own morality. You can't go from is to ought in any simple connection. You can't just say because this is the way wild animals behave, therefore this is the way.
I mean, you're saying we've developed to a degree that we can actually now choose the path we follow.
Absolutely.
I still don't know why. Why do you have to choose? Why choose generosity and why choose cooperation? Why choose it?
Ultimately, it comes down to me or other people who believe this persuading everyone else to adopt these values. Most people in civilized societies have already adopted them. They fortunately don't require me to tell them about it because they can do it anyway. So in other words, you have to persuade people who might not understand the point of generosity why they should be generous.
But isn't it even more than that?
It's actually saying human life anyway.
If you go and rob someone, we're actually going to put you in jail for it. It is actually wrong to do that. So there's a sense in which it's not just about you persuading people. It's about saying there's something that's actually wrong about what you're doing.
Okay, well, this brings us on to perhaps the most important issue we might have to discuss here, because certainly a society needs sanctions. It needs to be able to put people who've robbed or whatever, who are dangerous, in prison to stop them doing it again, possibly to deter them, to deter others. Those are valid reasons for having a prison system. But ultimately, you want to get to a reformative system, because the crucial point is that from the scientific point of view, every human being is simply a collection of atoms which obey the laws of physics. They could not have done otherwise than they did. That's an astounding thing to say. So even someone who has committed a murder or some other terrible act, from the humanist or from the scientific point of view, properly understood, you have no right to be vindictive and engage in retributive punishment. So you don't actually need to be told this by God or have Jesus to tell you about it or use his example. It's the automatic and necessary consequence of the fact that we are human beings and parts of the world of nature. So, okay, you might have to stop, just as you put a tiger in a cage, you might have to stop someone, restrain them, but there's no need for blame in that sense.
just got a few minutes in the remaining part of this program for you to respond, Tim, and then we'll move on to a different topic.
Well, I would say it sounds like Norman is saying that cruelty isn't actually wrong; it's just impractical. That if we're going to have an organized, harmonious society, acts of violence and cruelty are wrong. No, they're not wrong; they're just impractical. Because he doesn't have a basis for saying they're wrong. He can only say, yes, of course, strong eat the weak, that's how we did it up to now. But now we can choose this because it's more practical. And then we have to say that means you shouldn't do it because the only way to appeal to people to live like this, to live generously and kindly, etc., would be to appeal to their selfishness, to say, well, we want you to be generous not because it's right and to be stingy and violent is wrong, but because this is how you'll be happy. So you're actually encouraging self-centeredness, and you're jury-rigging their self-centeredness. You're not dealing with their self-centeredness by saying, this is the right and you need to submit to it. You need to humble yourself before the truth and the right. Instead, you're saying, well, this is the best way for you to be happy and for you to get your needs met. But, you know, some people are going to realize that they can get away with cruelty because there's nothing really wrong with cruelty. It's just impractical. And as long as it's just impractical, not wrong, they're going to do it over here and over here, wherever they can do it. I don't think you're going to get this great ethical society without belief in God.
Well, what really makes us human, I suppose, is what Timothy is saying, is that we choose the right thing because it's the right thing.
It's the right thing because it doesn't cause harm and causes, shall we say, pleasure or happiness. That's the definition I gave. Now, if you're dealing with criminals, it was suggested by Tim that unless they understand about God or what have you, they can't be reformed. I think that's not the case at all. One of the biggest problems, of course, is that many criminals leave their prison and they just go and commit another crime. So it's clearly important to have programs which make them clearly understand in detail the harm they've caused, etc., and make them come to realize what it is that they've done, which they may not properly do, and also the factors in their own upbringing that cause them to behave in that way. And this, I think, is the right way, a secular way, if you like, perfectly good way, a practical way of trying to get down the prison population and to make sure that people who want to get into that system don't return to it. It doesn't have to involve belief in God or some other transcendental thing. It doesn't need to do that.
Mm. I mean, you may not disagree with that, Tim.
Oh, I know that there's ways to for people who don't believe in God to be very, very decent and moral. I would never say that an individual can't lead a very moral and decent and humanitarian life unless they believed in God. I think that logically throughout a society, on the whole, it will be difficult for many, many, many people to be moral unless they believe the right thing is the right thing because it's the right thing. But I would never say that you couldn't rehabilitate a prisoner without belief in God. And I didn't mean to say that.
Okay. So.
Well, let's, I mean, unless there's anything you wanted to add, Norman, shall we move on to another section of the book? Anything you want to pick up in particular in regard to other chapters in The Reason for God? And I mean, perhaps in the area of whether the Bible is a good book for us to be referencing. I know that you've spoken to me before on how you can't see how the Bible can give a kind of moral mandate, if you like, for Christianity, given some of the episodes that occur in it.
I mean, even if one believed that the Bible was the word of God, that it contained revelation from some transcendental being, that would still not solve the problem. You'd still have to decide yourself whether it was good. How do you know that God is good and not a devil or evil? So this was pointed out by Socrates over 2,000 years ago, that just because the gods say something is good, it's not a reason for obedience. That, in other words, you can't get out of the fact that each individual has to themselves appreciate the value of it. And if you say that, that means we must have our own independent way of judging what we think is good and bad, right and wrong. And that means, okay, we can look up the past and we can see what other clever people have said, just as you might read Shakespeare. But you don't think Shakespeare is divine just because you couldn't have written that particular form of words. You know, it's done by a human being. Similarly, we may find great, profound sayings amongst people in the past. They're still the sayings of human beings, and we have to judge it and appreciate it. So I don't believe in what's called an objective morality, and the mere fact that God says it doesn't, to me, mean anything. It still has to be, he just gets one vote like anyone else.
and we are, at the end of the day, are the people who process what we believe is right and wrong.
Yes.
So, I mean, on that level, Tim, you might say it's all very well saying that Christianity gives us an ethical framework within which to work, but at the end of the day, aren't you the one who decides, yes, that is the right way of looking at life, and that isn't? Aren't you, you know, so that, you know, you may come to different conclusions to a Muslim who sees it a different way when they look at their own scriptures, etc.
Yes, I mean, our choices matter, and we have choices to make, and the choices really matter. But once you have made the decision, so in other words, when I decide that the Bible's true, then I actually do have to do that. I have to make that decision. But what Norman is suggesting is I never take that hat off. That is, that I all my life continue to use my own intuition, my own consciousness, as the straight edge by which I decide what in the Bible is right and what in the Bible is wrong. See, there's two ways to do this. One is I can use my consciousness and my sense, feelings, thoughts as the straight edge, and some things in the Bible fit that, some things in the Bible don't, in which case I'm God, in a sense. I mean, I am the wisdom. I have the wisdom. Or I can turn it around and I can actually have the Bible make the Bible the straight edge. And I have some feelings that, wow, this fits in with the Bible. And there's other things that I actually don't like that the Bible says, but I submit to it. So I either I make the Bible the straight edge and I pick and choose from in my own heart what's right and wrong, or I can make myself and my own consciousness the straight edge, and then I have to choose what's right and wrong in the Bible. The scary thing about that is everybody's straight edge is different. And Hitler had a straight edge, and there were things in the Bible he liked and things he didn't like. And if I just say, you know, the way in which we decide right and wrong is my own consciousness, then I really think that what's wrong with the way Hitler lived? I mean, you can go back to the utilitarianism, of course, and I granted a number of things that Norman said there. But if you're just asking me, how do I see it? Is it my choice or not? And the answer is, yeah, to start with. I have to decide this is where the truth is. But then I have to take that hat off and submit.
When Hitler came to power, he closed down all the atheist societies and believed that Christianity should be taught in schools. So I don't know using Hitler gets us very far. Just going back to the question of the straight edge and using the Bible or the Quran as your guide, just think of one practical example, divorce. Now, it just so happens that in Jewish and Islamic law, a man can divorce a woman by some fairly simple process, but the woman can't divorce the man by an equally simple process. That seems to be the way it's practiced. And if you suggest to a rabbi or an imam that this really is out of date these days, surely it should be more symmetrical and what have you, they say, well, this is God's law. We cannot change it. It says it in the Bible. So I think that is the reason why humanists and atheists say this is just a shackle that you've put on yourself by adopting this allegedly divine law, and you're simply causing actual real misery to people today by adhering to it.
I mean, once we do get into specific instances of moral situations, it gets a lot more complicated because we then have to work through things. But I mean, if we were to take this and go around with it a bit, what do you think? I guess you have to speak from a Christian point of view.
I'll be more general. Right, you're right. We could, and you do have a limited period of time here. See, I would say the Bible actually sits in some judgment on both individualistic societies and collectivistic societies. And what Norman's talking about is you have some societies in which the individual has no rights. The woman has no rights. The child has no rights. There's, you know, some societies in which the father can kill the child if he wants. They have that kind of power. On the other hand, in the West, we have what I would call radical individualism, where my needs are more important than the common good. I think actually Christianity is really, look at where it came up from, where the Bible came from. It's really neither a Western or Eastern. It's not really a faith that lifts up the family or the clan as the absolute or the individual. I think it sits in judgment on both. And actually, I would say many of the things that, you know, Norman would consider, many of the things I can tell Norman would consider atrocities and very bad for society, I actually, as a Bible-believing Christian, would agree with. That's all. So I still believe in taking a straight edge, because something's going to be a straight edge. It's either going to be my personal heart and consciousness, or something that millions of people have found over the years to really be a, you know, source of wisdom. I'd rather submit to a tradition than set myself up as the arbiter of all truth.
And is that because you don't believe humans have the capacity to be the straight edge?
Yes, I don't trust my own heart. I used Hitler, admitting, you know, Norman rightly so kind of, you know, did a little number on me there. I mean, Hitler isn't a great example because of what he did. But the point is that there are plenty of atheists. There are plenty of atheist, official atheist societies that were violent, official Muslim societies that were violent, official Christian societies that were violent. And I would say, as a Bible-believing Christian, all of them were violating the things the Bible says about the Golden Rule, which, and therefore, I still would rather say, this is right because it's right.
Mm.
And you need to submit to it, submit your self-centeredness, get out of your self-centeredness, submit your consciousness to it. And frankly, if you do the Golden Rule, an awful lot of the atrocities that we're talking about here would never have been picked up. So, I don't look to Christianity. I look to the idea of a biblical straight edge rather than Christianity in general.
Mm.
Just one point. Tim referred to individualism as though if you're an atheist, you have to be an individualist. I think he meant someone who was selfish and only looked after himself. I don't see that as necessarily following at all. If I just quote Jeremy Bentham, who was a utilitarian philosopher in the 19th century, he had this phrase, the greatest happiness of the greatest number, which is the kind of thing you can use in politics. You can decide that it's better for the population as a whole that everyone pays income tax and the rich pay more income tax and it gets distributed in various ways to the poor. So that is looking at it from the point of view of the greatest number of people, what would increase their happiness. So if you're rich, you may not want to pay more tax, but nevertheless, it might be the correct, it might be the most moral thing to do. So it doesn't follow that because you're an atheist, it determines your politics necessarily.
Can I ask Norman a question instead of coming through? Actually, I'm not assuming, Norman, this is true, but that what I've heard Christians come after Jeremy Bentham by saying, well, why, if a majority decides that it would make them happier, would be in their best interest to, say, rob a minority of all their income, because that would be the greatest good for the greatest good. I mean, how would you say there it was wrong then? How would you argue against?
Well, I'm sure that they probably did. The rich people may have said, this is robbery. Well, this is our money. It's ours. How can the government take it from us? But as we've said before, you can cause an increase in happiness or pleasure, but not at the expense of causing pain. And I don't really think that raising someone's income tax if they're a millionaire does cause real pain. You know, it's just something that you have to decide. It's, of course, it's a judgment. It's tolerable. You're not really causing them to suffer.
I mean, so, it's interesting, though, resorting to you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. It sounds like there's some inbuilt rules underneath your utilitarianism, which say these are the non-negotiables. And isn't what Timothy's just saying is that I recognise there are non-negotiables, and so therefore there is some kind of objective morality. I mean, why shouldn't we cause pain to other people in order to further our own pain? Doesn't it go beyond this communal aspect? It seems like there's justice really does exist. It really is wrong to, you know, steal candy from a baby. Isn't that kind of something everyone kind of knows
deep down? If you want a moral absolute, then one can put it in that form, one can say that it is wrong to cause unnecessary pain. That's a period, and that's really an absolute moral rule. It's not it's subjective in the sense that it's my opinion, and I hope it would be the opinion of everybody else.
Do you hope it would be the opinion of everyone else? Because you believe it's true, presumably.
No, not because it's true in the sense that Paris is the capital of France is a true fact. It's not a fact in that sense. It still remains a value judgment, but it's a value that, I mean, this is the human predicament. We have to persuade people by education, by their, etc., the way they're brought up, to come to believe these principles. And I don't see any other way.
I always have these discussions with people on my programme, and I can never see how that works in practice, because at the end of the day, it seems like you've got to, if you are trying to persuade someone that something is the right thing to do, I just have to ask, well, why should you do that? What's the moral imperative? I mean, we won't go there, though, because I'm just aware that we've been around this subject a lot.
I can just say that I think it's in Gibbon's Roman Empire. He talks about the Roman religion and how it was regarded. There were three different views of it. The populace believed in their religion and their gods and their sacrifices. The philosophers amongst the Romans believed it was all false. But the magistrates, those responsible for law and order, believed it was useful. In other words, the religion has a useful function in keeping people in order, and this has always been one of its functions. But if you want to be rigorously true, you have to, you know, it's convenient to say there is a God who is watching everything you do, and it seems to work to keep people in order. But is it true? I don't think it is.
I'm with you in trying to get to another subject.
But yes.
Something that's germane. It's not a direct response to Norman, but it's in the book that I thought I might mention. There's an article I read. I reference in the book a secular, an atheist, a really good. She was an anthropologist, and she taught, I think, at either Brown or University of Rhode Island. I forget where it was. And she wrote an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education some years ago that I reference. And she was doing research amongst in Africa, and she realized that she was very upset with female genital mutilation. She saw women in this part of Africa being oppressed. And when she started to raise her voice about it, everyone in that culture, all the powers that be, said, "You cannot impose Western values here. You cannot which is utilitarianism would be considered by them an absolutely Western value. They would say this is the greatest good for the greatest number for us to treat the women this way. You can't come in here with your idea of universal rights." And she was as an anthropologist said. As a secular person, I actually don't believe there's an absolute right and wrong. I do believe that actually all morality is socially conditioned. I also believe I probably don't have the right to therefore say that what's going on here is wrong. I'm white. I'm from the West. And yet she said, actually, in my own view of life, I didn't have any reason to actually believe that what was happening was absolutely wrong, but she says, "I couldn't help it." And then she decided to go after, and she says, I'm going to do what I can to stop it, even though I'm imposing my cultural values, I'm imposing my Western values.
Yeah.
And she went after it. And she, so, and I think, as a Christian, I see that she just knew.
Just five words. The child who is being cut about by a piece of dirt, broken glass on this genital mutilation. Her pain is real. It's not a Western invention. It's universal. And that's why these values are universal.
But your belief
universal.
That we should interrupt that
certainly.
Is just your opinion.
By the most appropriate means. That their tradition, they do it for some tradition.
Absolutely.
And they've just got to be told why this tradition is, like burning of widows and all the other traditions, are obsolete.
Yeah. Okay, once you've imposed... But again, it's just your opinion against their opinion, no. Because there's no actual truth.
But who is the they? I'm saying the victim in these particular practices knows perfectly well she does not want to have this operation done on her.
Right,
and
well...
What about taking her opinion into account? This anthropologist has got it wrong.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave that discussion there because we've nearly got to the end of the program and we've only really been around one particular issue.
We're having a good program.
We are having
brother.
A great program. and all I will say is that if you want to read The Reason for God, you won't just find an extended argument for morality for God. You'll find all kinds of different arguments. Let me just ask you, gents, to maybe just prepare a little bit of a summing up, as it were, as we approach the end of the programme. And particularly be interested to find from you, Tim, how your experience in New York has particularly kind of fed into the book and the kind of questions people are asking. Before you come back with that, let me say, if you're listening and you'd like to respond yourself to anything you've heard on the programme, then I'd love to hear from you. The email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget this programme available online right now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you've enjoyed it and you'd like to send it on to someone, do email them the link and maybe subscribe to the podcast while you're there.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the show that aims to get you thinking and doing that with a classic replay this week. We'll hear the final part of the discussion between Tim Keller and Norman Backrack, all the way back from 2009. It was the first time I had Tim Keller on the show. He had recently published The Reason for God, has gone on to publish many, many more books since, and we've had him on the show a number of times since. And I'll give you a little update on the situation with his health as well towards the end of today's show. I've got some fresh material for you, though, next week. Come back for William Lane Craig. He's recently published a major new work on atonement and the death of Christ, in which he defends penal substitutionary atonement as the core motif of Scripture when it comes to how Christ's death has paid for sin. Well, William Lane Craig, well known as a Christian apologist and philosopher and theologian, he'll be discussing that view with another well-known church leader and theologian, Greg Boyd, who rejects the idea that God punished Jesus instead of us on the cross and champions instead the Christus Victor view, that Jesus overcame the powers of darkness on the cross and rejects the sort of violent view of God that he believes is often portrayed in penal substitutionary atonement. So look out for that, a debate on the cross and atonement between William Lane Craig and Greg Boyd this time next week. If you can stay on this evening here on Premier Christian Radio for The Profile at 8 p.m, you'll be hearing from retired police superintendent Leroy Logan, who's the former chair of the Black Police Association and author of the recently published book Closing Ranks, My Life as a Cop. That should be fascinating tonight at 8, or indeed you can go and find that wherever you get your podcast from. Before the end of the show, we've got plenty of your feedback as well, especially on last week's show on coronavirus. We had a sort of panel discussion on that as I was joined by guests who had joined me at the beginning of lockdown. Some people saying it was a bit lopsided. We'll hear why during the feedback section of today's show. But for now, let's wrap up today's classic replay between Tim Keller and Norman Backrack.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Norman, some of your final thoughts as we wrap up.
I don't believe that there is a God who judges people on the basis of what they've done, because God is meant to be omniscient. He knows everything, and therefore he fully understands why every human action is the inevitable result of that particular person's genes plus environment, everything that's happened to them. And because of that, there's no justice whatsoever in retributive punishment or hell or any of these doctrines, hell or heaven. So since they're an important part of the Christian doctrine, that religion must be false because it doesn't make sense.
Okay, thank you very much. Would you like to respond, Tim, and give your summing up?
Well, the response to that would be, Norman's assuming that people can't help it, because he's assuming that we are nothing but matter. And therefore, we're the product of our social conditioning and our genetic makeup, etc. He said originally. He says they can't help but do that. So, if there is no soul, if there's no immaterial aspect, if there's no such thing, therefore, as free will, and I actually agree with him that if there is no God, there really isn't such a thing as free will, really. Then he's right. But you see, the premise there was, since there is no God and there is no immaterial part of the human being, people can't help what they're doing, and therefore retributive punishment is unjust. But he actually assumed God, I think, in order to disprove God. I actually think that actually happens a lot. If you say there's so much evil and suffering in the world, how could God allow that? I can't believe in God. But that assumes a standard of right and wrong outside of the natural order, which is filled with violence anyway. So anyway, here's my summing up. My summing up is that when I listen to Norman, he sounds really smart and really reasonable. I never have felt that people who disbelieve in Christianity or in God aren't smart or reasonable. In fact, I'm always partly convinced every time I hear somebody doubt. And the reason I believe in Christianity is because on the whole, it makes more sense than the skeptical approaches. But I don't think that the skeptical approaches hold no water. I very often find that the skeptics think that belief in God holds almost no water at all. I actually think disbelief in God holds a lot of water. There's a lot of reasons to disbelieve in God. But on the whole, there's more reasons too than not. And that's what I try to do in the book, is not to say, here's a slam dunk proof. I just say, in general, belief in God makes more sense of life, I think, than disbelief in God. Once you believe that, then you can proceed to sort of look at the Christian claims about Christianity. See, for me, I can't prove God, but when I decided it was more likely than not that he was there, then I was open to looking at what the Bible said. And when I actually found Christ personally, that moved me from believing that Christianity was probably true to being absolutely true. So it's a combination of the intellect and the experience that creates a Christian, not just the intellect. And so I never would look at what Norman's saying as, that's just crazy. That's not actually, lots of it makes a lot of sense.
There you go. That discussion between Norman Bachrach and Tim Keller actually took place in 2009. So a bit of a gem from the archives that I took out, polished up, and decided to present again, because many people never get that far back in the archives. But I thought that was a really interesting conversation. And just to update you on both of them. Well, Norman Bachrach continues to write on issues around humanism and philosophy, particularly the problem of consciousness and determinism, obviously, that you will have heard him talking about on today's show. Tim Keller has, of course, published numerous books since The Reason for God and moved on from his ministry at Redeemer. Was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and back in June he wrote on social media, "Less than 3 weeks ago, I didn't know I had cancer. Today, I'm headed to the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health for additional testing before beginning chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer next week in New York City." He does say, though, that he has felt God present and felt physically great as he's undergone initial test biopsies and surgery, and does see it as a providential intervention that doctors caught the cancer when they did. He says, "I have terrific human doctors, but most importantly, I have the great physician himself caring for me." So, that's the update on Tim Keller. He's undergoing chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer. But if you'd like to respond to anything you heard on today's show, you're more than welcome to do that as well. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via our socials as well, at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. You can find me over at Instagram as Justin.Briley as well. Well, let's get to some of your feedback, because there's a bulging mailbag responding to all kinds of shows that we've had in recent weeks. Just a quick shout out to Andy Scarcliffe, who says, "Been meaning to email for some time to say thanks for the show. I recently listened to the Dave Rubin and John Lennox discussion and to the council culture discussion just recently, and have pretty well been through the whole back catalogue. Your approach is unique. I love the respectful way you deal with opposing viewpoints, the formidable intellects you get on the show, and the totally fearless way you confront some of the huge questions the culture is throwing at the church. Unbelievable is unfazed." And you go on to say you've actually been contributing recently bits and pieces to Premier Christian Radio, and you're talking about the possibility of further involvement. You're a retired Baptist minister, so you enjoy planning possible shows. Thank you very much, Andy. Look forward to hearing more from you in due course on the radio station. You say you still miss EMF, though. Yes, the original Epson Mad Funkers with their unbelievable song that used to herald the beginning and end of the show each week. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the new theme music as well. Lots and lots of responses as well to the issue of coronavirus. That was last week's debate. well, not really a debate. It was more a conversation between people who were essentially, I would say, on the same page when it came to coronavirus. But really fascinating to hear different perspectives that were there from AJ Roberts, who was our virologist, Mark Sayers from Australia. Ruth Jackson joined us on the show, my wife, Lucy. And here's some of the comments that came in. Pamela says she thinks an important point was missed. In the USA, it's been estimated that 23 million people have protested during the pandemic without any criticism or restrictions by public officials. I believe Christians have a problem with this dichotomy. You can protest, yell and scream without a mask, disregard social distancing, but you can't go to church. If you can attend church, you must sign up in advance. Very limited seating. In fact, last week we couldn't get a seat, a limit of 100 people in a church that would normally seat 1,000, and there's no singing in church. So Pamela, not feeling that there's a contradiction there between the way some groups are treated and others. Derek, on the other hand, says, thank you for hosting this topic. I've had 4 mini debates with fellow Christians, all of whom were genuinely conflicted about whether they should comply with the wisdom and counsel of health experts. Typically, their concern was on showing a failure of faith. As for me, I felt like I was debating with them for their very lives, like talking a person down from the ledge of a building. What I pointed out was that Jesus was on a ledge too in Luke 4 when he found himself on the roof of the temple. The devil tempted Jesus to jump off the building on the basis of the promises in Psalm 91. Misapplying these verses, the devil suggested that God would still effectuate the promises even if Jesus acted recklessly. Instead of showing concern about a lack of faith, Jesus rebuked the devil on the basis that Scripture also teaches us not to test God's provision by acting in reckless ways. The devil tempted Jesus to recklessly throw his life away, even though Christ was called to responsibly give it up in order to bring humanity close to God. The point I pressed was this: it's unbiblical to act recklessly in this pandemic and still expect God to exercise protective promises. You say the second point that I press is that people often misunderstand the religious protections afforded to them under the US Constitution. Without the volumes of nuance, exceptions or caveats, here it is in a nutshell. Religious beliefs are absolutely protected, whereas religious practices are not. This is the reason that government entities, without running afoul of the US Constitution, were permitted to outlaw the practice of using peyote, despite its use in some Native American religious ceremonies. This is also the reason that government entities were allowed to outlaw the practice of polygamy, despite its use in the Mormon religion. In the case of this pandemic, no government entity is taking measures to prevent people from believing or practicing Christianity. Government health guidelines instead are designed to help Christians practice it in ways that are not reckless. We Christians should be thankful, in accord with Romans 13, that our government takes an interest in protecting our health. And some people felt there was an imbalance in as much as there wasn't really anyone who was questioning to a great degree the way that many governments have responded with lockdown measures and so on. So here's a few of those who came in on that front. Amy Lamaster got in touch to say, I've never thanked you for all you do, and I'm sad because now I have a concern. I feel I've been disappointed with the more liberal and one-sided slant of the podcast recently. I've been listening to the show for many years and have recommended it to Christian and non-Christian family members and friends. But this latest podcast was extremely disappointing. I do not believe that COVID is a conspiracy or a hoax, but I do believe that many governments are overstepping their authority, especially when they allow and encourage protests and funerals of famous people and focus mainly on limiting conservative and Christian gatherings. There has been a lot of harm done because of the choices our governments are making, and they are worth discussing. It wasn't fair to ask your guests what they thought about John MacArthur's church being open and then have a one-sided conversation calling his decision selfish. People who choose to go to his church and defy the government are doing that by their own free will and conviction. No one's being forced to go against their will. And when you discuss teenagers having mental health issues and struggles because of these extended lockdowns, you went against your previous conversation. It could be considered selfish to keep teens and children locked at home when they're more likely to die from a lightning strike than they are from the virus. I'm a mother of many boys, a mother-in-law, grandmother, and mentor of teen girls. There are a lot of hidden struggles, suicides, and substance abuse because of these lockdowns. There's so much we don't know about this virus, and the conversation was very one-sided and condescending towards people who don't agree with everything you said. Do value your ministry greatly. I don't want your podcast to join the chorus of voices already out there, says Amy. Okay, thank you, Amy. Message heard. And Mindy in Florida on a similar way says, I listened to the whole discussion. It was lopsided. There are a swathe of people in the middle between the conspiracy theorists and those totally compliant who believe the virus is real yet don't think it's as dangerous as all your guests do. I wish you'd focus more on actual data, with estimates of IFR converging at approximately 0.5 to 1%. Staying locked in the house seems a bit ridiculous. Could it be the data that are driving people to non-compliance? You did mention the inconsistency in the scientific messaging, but it was never addressed by any of your guests, not to mention that the experts and scientists don't agree, although the panel assumed that they do. Thank you very much, Mindy. And Bob Garner, in the title of his email, said, is this a lockdown shill? I've started by saying that I love the Unbelievable podcast, been listening to nearly every show for several years, but perhaps it's my love for the show that causes me to be so disappointed in the recent coronavirus edition. It felt more like a propaganda broadcast than a show that aims to get you thinking. All your guests seem to be wholeheartedly committed to the lockdown, and their comments seem to be aimed at painting everyone who disagrees either as a conspiracy theorist or someone who's more focused on my rights than the leading of the Holy Spirit. A good bit of energy was expended, criticising John MacArthur and his church, for example, but no one was on the show to defend Dr. MacArthur's position. Instead, a straw man was constructed of the typical American fighting for his rights above all else. This straw man was predictably easy to tear down, but wouldn't it be better to have a thoughtful, lockdown-breaking proponent on the show to present their own position? You go on to talk about some of these same issues that others have mentioned here, particularly mental health concerns among the youth and the elderly. Some might argue that humans are spiritual animals, and that there is much more to total human health than simply avoiding viral diseases. They might argue that even those physically vulnerable to this virus are not well served by being isolated from their loved ones. They might have multiple powerful arguments with good evidence and sound reasoning, but we didn't get that perspective. So we're left to assume there are no good counter-arguments. Anyway, I hear you, and I'll just add to the chorus, Ryan in Kansas, who says, while I appreciate the relatively common sense approach that all the participants have had on how the virus impacts the church, I'd value getting a diverse set of opinions on how the church should respond. Isn't that the entire point of the Unbelievable show? Thank you very much. Message received loud and clear, and we will make sure that when we do return to this subject, we do bring some diversity of opinion on that to you. And there are, of course, a number of people who have voiced concerns about whether various governments are doing things the right way and making the most of the possibilities. Thank you very much to all those who have been in touch on that. I had one. I wasn't quite sure what to make of this from Patrick, to be honest. I'll let you be the judge. Hello, says Patrick. Wear kilts, not masks. No more masquerade. As we know that coronavirus is not as dangerous as was described, it's time to cope with more serious health problems. We have a real pandemic, epidemic of civilization diseases like cancer, allergy, diabetes, and all those diseases have one common cause, DNA. We were told we can do nothing about this problem, just try to cure the symptoms and die. Well, it's not true. Since 2015, we have known the reason that these diseases spread. Read carefully, especially page 17, and you've linked me to a particular paper. In it, you say that the author proved that the main factor that causes DNA damage and boosts the spread of diseases are, get this, men in trousers. Yes, trousers of any kind, tight, loose, short, long, doesn't matter, always lead to certain types of heat stress that are seminal to DNA damage, causing the cancer and other diseases. That's the first time I've heard that theory, I will say this, and I have absolutely no idea whether it's true or not, Patrick, but your ultimate advice is we should go back to wearing kilts. That's the way to deal with our modern diseases. Okay, I will leave that one there. Let's talk determinism before we run out of time on today's show, because we had a great discussion 2 weeks ago between Braxton Hunter and Dan Barker on whether illusion is a free will. And this really got you thinking. So many responses that have come into this. Here's Ben, who says, I've long enjoyed the show from overseas, but I was disappointed that Braxton Hunter didn't spring the trap that Dan Barker carefully laid for himself through the whole of that discussion on free will. Because Mr. Barker spent some time describing how our perceptions are illusory, using depth perception as an illustration, but then later insisted that our access to math, science, reason, and knowledge by means of those same perceptions is objective, yet Dr. Hunter didn't call him on it. One can spend a lifetime debating and never get a setup that good. Perhaps Braxton was predetermined to be too nice, says Ben out in Athens, Georgia. Tim in Saskatoon says, I was excited hearing about a discussion on free will, but after listening, I was left with a sense of discontentment. I understand that there are many understandings of how free will is defined, even from a Christian perspective, so I wasn't shocked when my particular understanding wasn't addressed. But considering this was an atheist Christian conversation, I was expecting at least a biblical position to be put forth. But upon having listened carefully, had I not been informed of the religious perspective of either participant, I wouldn't have concluded that one had a biblical framework. There were plenty of arguments made from a naturalistic, evolutionistic, deterministic understanding, as to be expected, but nothing biblical, not even a reference from Scripture, nor allusion to it. So rather than a response to this particular conversation, this is more an observation of what was exemplified in this conversation. The general stance of Christians in today's secular culture who would rather wax philosophical than engage a topic from a position of scriptural authority. Thank you very much, Tim. I haven't got time to read the whole of your message, but I take it you probably come from what is often called a presuppositional point of view, that you should always sort of just stand on the truth of Scripture whenever you engage in any kind of debate, and that should be enough. I would counter that personally. I think there are certain types of debates where you can't simply say, well, this is what the Bible says, deal with it. I think this was the kind of debate where we wanted to take it at a philosophical level and kind of tease out the implications of a sort of naturalistic, deterministic viewpoint. And I think Braxton did a very good job of that, actually. I mean, Braxton, of course, believes in the authority of Scripture as well. He just didn't see that that was the place to make arguments from that particular angle in this kind of a discussion. But I appreciate you have a different perspective on that. Let's go to one more from Paul in Belfast, responding to this discussion between Dan Barker and Braxton. Dan Barker's first statement, says Paul, was that the Freedom From Religion Foundation is a free thinkers group. And he later said, I didn't choose how the neurons fire in my brain. The irony seemed lost on him. If he's right about free will, then he isn't a free thinker. There are only reactions going on in his brain forcing him to think a certain way. Yet, there he was having a debate on the subject. His theory totally contradicts reality, which he more or less admitted. He said he thought we should embrace the illusion of free will, but on his view, even the thought that we should embrace the illusion was a thought that was determined by blind forces acting on mindless matter. How likely is it that blind forces acting on mindless matter in a completely deterministic way would result in art, literature, equations that describe the workings of the universe, and a book and debate about free will? Not very. He also said that some people need to be locked up to protect us because their brains aren't working right. But that presumes there is a quote-unquote right way our brains are meant to work. But on Dan's view, there are no goal-directed forces of any kind. There's no way a brain is supposed to work. All the physical stuff of the universe is doing the only thing it can do. There's nothing it is meant to be doing. And saying we should lock them up also presumes we have a decision to make or a will to exercise. But on his view, they will be locked up if the laws of physics and chemistry make it happen. We have no say in the matter. Dan showed the whole way through the discussion that his theory is unworkable in practice. It doesn't match reality, says Paul in Belfast. Thank you very much. Yes, and many more interesting pieces as well that have come in on that from both sides, actually. So just a smattering, really, on this feedback section of some of what's come in response to both of those recent shows. Thank you very much. Again, you can email in your thoughts, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always enjoy hearing from you via the social media as well. And we'll just close out with one final message that's coming from Grant. Lovely message to receive this. Always love these encouraging messages. My name is Grant. I'm writing to you from Des Moines, Iowa in the USA. Have been a listener of Unbelievable for a few years now. I'm a big podritioner, as Greg Boyd puts it, but have never written into the show. I can't thank you enough for the massive amount of mental and spiritual growth I can attribute to you and the show. Your book has been on my reading list for some time now, and I finally came around to reading it this past week. You write about faith in such a beautiful way in the steps of C.S. Lewis and Sheldon Vonnegut. It was a deeply enriching book to read, and I especially loved your final chapter, Choosing to Live in the Christian Story of Reality. I recently took the course Perspectives on the World Christian Movement, where one of the main points for students to learn is that wherever Christianity has been planted in healthy ways, communities have prospered. This is deeply encouraging to me, as my wife and I are currently waiting to move to England to be missionaries ourselves, and we find much excitement at the thought of serving in the UK, but would never want to do so in a way that bolsters American ideals or ethnocentric ministry approaches. How you spoke about the flexibility of Christianity to speak to all people in all cultures at all times is one of my favourite parts of Christianity, and an apologetic all of its own. Christianity is not just a white man's faith. In fact, for over 30 years, more Christians have lived in the global south than in the Western world. This is part of why my wife and I feel called to England, to serve and foster Christian communities where Christendom was born and secularism now reigns. Your book has given me hope, wisdom and counsel as we prepare to move in the coming months, COVID restrictions permitting. On another side note, one of my favourite parts of listening to certain shows regularly, yours is a favourite along with Greg Boyd's Ask NT Write Anything, Preston Sprinkle's Theology in the Raw and a new podcast called Regenerate with Tony Scarsello, is seeing the moderator or host grow and change over time. I do sometimes wish we could share a beer after I finish a podcast, as I wonder how you're wrestling with the debate that just ensued. Seeing some of your book endorsements, such as Bruxy Cavey and having other Anabaptist-ish Christians on your programme, gives me wonder where you stand on a host of issues, violence, politics, etc. But alas, you are such a great moderator, I'm often left still wondering at the end, though I will say I can tell when you're quite keen on a specific issue when you have Christian debates between alternative views. Anyway, just want to say thank you. Your words in Unbelievable, the book, have challenged me, and your approach on the show have inspired me. Thank you very much, Grant, for getting in touch, and all the very best to you and your wife as you seek to answer that call to come to the UK. We will have a beer, I'm sure, when that happens, COVID restrictions permitting, of course. Thanks for being with us on today's Classic Replay show, and I'm going to tell you in just a moment what's coming up next week. Don't forget, though, you can keep in touch with the show via our newsletter. Find it over at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And if you're listening out in America, why not check out our new US-focused show page, unbelievable.show, where you can sign up for exclusive resources that we're making available across North America, unbelievable.show. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. And if I sound a bit excited, it's because I am. Because it's not every day you get William Lane Craig on the show. He's a well-known Christian philosopher and apologist, and has recently published a major new work on atonement and the death of Christ, defending penal substitutionary atonement as the core motif in Scripture when it comes to how Christ's death has paid for sin. Well, he'll be discussing that view with church leader and theologian Greg Boyd, who simply doesn't take the same perspective on this as Bill. I think this will be a thrilling theological discussion next week. Hope you can join us for it. For the moment, thank you very much for being with me on the show today, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.